Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm Tom Alderson, the Leeds fan on Tuesday night of the podcast. Oh my god, we're never going to win again. We're losing to Coventry in the playoffs. This is the worst thing ever. And I'm joined today by the Leeds fan on Wednesday night of the podcast, Dan Holdsworth. 1 point gained on Leicester, 0 points lost on Ipswich. Not a bad midweek, really. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, mate. I've kind of been out of the Leeds United loop last few weeks. I was on holiday abroad for the Hull and Watford game, and then it was my son's birthday on the Coventry game, so I've just kind of ignored Leeds a little bit and just like kept on top of the scores. So I feel like a bit of a fraud coming here. It's my first game back at the road for a while, Sunderland. So it's kind of nice to get back into the Leeds United group. It's been kind of nice having a bit of a mental break from them as well.
Yeah, I do get you. Obviously, there was the international break, and then I was in Copenhagen over the Easter weekend.
Yeah.
So I watched the Watford and Hull games there. And so I kind of was like, oh, Leeds is on, and this is a bit annoying, but I'm away. It's fine. And then I went to the last two games. So I feel like I watched back the Sunderland game yesterday. I feel like that's the first time I've properly watched a game of Leeds in about a month where I've actually thought about it from a proper analytical tactics point of view rather than just vibes, really.
Yeah, same here.
So, as we've hinted at, we're here to review the 0-0 draw with Sunderland at Elland Road. In terms of news, there are two pretty big bits of news this week, and I will start with the definite worst one, which is Leeds United's finances for their relegation season in the Premier League. So, I'm going to just quote what Kieran Maguire has put on this because he is definitely the man to go for this, and he's it's like his summary tweet. So, revenue is 190 million, which is about the same. Wages are 146 million, which is up 20%. They paid Jesse Marsh 9.5 million to leave, which I think, frankly, is not enough.
Was that Jesse Marsh and Gracia and probably Sam Allardyce?
That's true. Actually, I didn't include that. Well, yeah. I'm just going to say it's all Jesse Marsh.
Yeah, blame Marsh.
Player costs were £120 for every £100 of revenue. It was an operating loss of 106 million. Spent 170 million on player purchases, and I don't really know what we got for that apart from Sinisterra, maybe. Player sales, 86 million. And then, whilst I scroll frantically, there was something else I wanted to put. Oh, there was also the fact that Leeds agreed with Augustin a 5-year deal worth £93,000 a week, which has come out this week.
Yeah.
But, not great. There was something about transfers as well, wasn't there? Like they owed 190 million in transfer instalments, and then they were just due 2 million in incoming. So not a pretty picture really on the finances from last year, is it?
No, I mean, the upside is Kieran Maguire said that we were within, after sales, we were within profit and sustainability, or whatever it's called nowadays, limit of 35 million. And we had like a loss after sales of low 30s, and the year before was low 30s, so we're within the limits. So I presume if we go back up, we're fine on profit sustainability. And that's fine as long as the owners are prepared to put cash in to keep the cash flow situation, because you've got like the accounting side of it, haven't you? And then you've got the actual cash flow side of it. So if the P&S is fine and the cash flow sounds pretty bad to me, I mean, like, we owe money on transfers and we've got all our money up front for the players we've sold and we've backdated all our payments and the ones we've bought in the past. So that's like a cash flow issue, isn't it, rather than a P&S one, because the transfers have already been booked. So as long as the 49ers are prepared to keep putting cash in, the club's fine. You know, it's, I don't know if it's technically solvent, but it will remain solvent. So it's perhaps not as bad as it seems, although I'd hate it to be my business. So, but yeah, I mean, the money was spent on some pretty dross players like Brendan Harrison and Rasmus Christensen, and, you know, got on and on, and bad managers like Jesse Marsh and Sam Allardyce. It's just, it just shows how out of control things were, doesn't it? The kind of amount of money. What was it? We had the 11th highest wage bill in the Premier League last year. And we were the second,
that was the other one, yeah.
Yeah, like, second worst in the league. You know, spent loads of money. The only good thing is that we might get some of that money back on some of those players. You know, like obviously we've already got our money back on Sinisterra, haven't we? We'll probably get something back on Rasmus. I don't know, bag of training bibs or something. And
yeah,
I don't know. So yeah, it's really bad. But I think in football terms, I've seen worse from like clubs like Everton and what have you, and most of the Championship.
Yeah, I guess my main takeaway from it was that if we don't go up this year, we're not in trouble, but we knew we had to sell players, but we've lost that TV revenue as well. So it's suddenly like the money coming to the club is really not as big as it once was. And you're going to struggle to get that quality players in to push on next season, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you assume that if we don't go up, then there's going to have to be, on top of Sinisterra, who we've already sold or the deal's already agreed, you'd have to expect there'd be two or three other large-ish sales, you know, like 15 million plus sales to cover, you know, whatever incomings we do. So, you know, obviously everyone's talking about Somerville going. You'd expect maybe Nonto. We get some bids on Nonto. You know, we're not going to be signing the likes of Roden, are we? So, and you would perhaps think Jack Harrison might go. So there might be those kind of three sort of players that go for reasonable money, and we'll probably then be stuck with the likes of Aronson, aren't we? Because I don't think anyone's going to want to loan him. So, yeah, I think it'll be tough next year, but we do have saleable assets that can probably help balance the books in the Championship. But if we don't go up again in the second year, then I think we'd have to really cut our cloth, and that would be frustrating. So yeah, fingers crossed we go up this year.
Yeah, could be worse then. That's the takeaway I'll take.
I think
from
could
that.
Be worse. Yeah, we've still got talent, haven't we? You know, there's good young players at the club. We've got assets like Archie Gray to develop, haven't we? And I think we're all enjoying Matteo Joseph. So another year in the Championship, you'd fancy him having a big season, wouldn't you? So you feel like there's assets and players to develop there and things to build on again. So
let's move on to, I wouldn't say it's good news this one, but it's slightly, I don't know, nicer news to talk about, which is Stuart Dallas officially retiring. So he hasn't played for 2 years, but obviously for what his involvement in those Bielsa teams was, he's probably like a recent club legend, you've got to say, haven't you?
Yeah, just like a top guy, but like someone who really kind of adapted really well to like Bielsa, and he was someone that just kind of seemed to get what the Bielsa system was about, and it was very adaptable guy, played well at fullback, played okay at centre mid, you know, scored some important goals, and just kind of epitomised the whole kind of ethos of that team, wasn't it? Like run, 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 and just run yourself to water, you know, every game, and he was very much that. And like I say, came across as a really good guy. Obviously, a couple of really great goals, great moments for him. The goal at Stoke, which is probably one of my favourite Bielsa goals in the whole period. And then obviously that great goal at Man City, which was like really fun to do.
It's probably my favourite. That goal against City was probably one of my favourite moments in like lockdown football.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely mental, that.
I remember I was at my mum and dad's that day, helping my dad with a patio, and I just came in and I was like, kind of half trying to watch it on the laptop. And like, we beat Man City. My dad's like, what? He's not really a football fan, but he's like, what? Have you done that? Kind of thing. So it was quite my mood that day. Yeah, it was really, yeah, that was really, yeah. I mean, the Stoke goal's my personal favourite, because it was one of the best, like Bielsa's got a team goals, wasn't it? And, you know, like another player who I underappreciate, player like Adam Forshaw was involved, nice pass from him. And then obviously the perfect Pablo weighted through ball for Dallas just to run onto. And it was just lovely, wasn't it? It's like poetry, wasn't it, really, watching it?
Yeah. Like I say, he was definitely just an epitome of that Bielsa team. Probably him and Click, I would say, summed it up the most.
Yeah.
And yeah, so just great for the club at the time. And
just,
I can't
just a good
say
guy.
A bad word about him, really.
Yeah, everyone likes him, don't they? Everyone's got a good word to say about him. It'd be interesting to see what he does next, if he's interested in coaching. I don't know if he's that way inclined or what, but you know, seemed like a fairly switched-on fella, so you'd fancy him having a career somewhere in football. perhaps.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's move on to something worse then. So let's talk about the Leeds-Sunderland game on Tuesday night. So this, originally, in the group chat, we were calling this Doom Pod, but after last night, maybe not as much as Doom Pod, but still not ideal. I will go through the game summary, as always, which is a much more brief than normal, considering anyone that watched the game will understand why. So Leeds set up in a 4-2-3-1 shape, with Sunderland opting for a 3-4-3. The game started with both teams trying to feel each other out, with both teams struggling to create chances. Leeds had the better of possession for the first half hour, although it was Sunderland who had the better of the limited opportunities. Leeds were happy to retain possession between the centre-backs and the double pivot, with any advances forward seemingly only coming down the left-hand side. Sunderland had the best at the end of the first half, but neither side went into half-time with any big chances of note. The second half started very similarly to the first, with the crowd trying to push Leeds on, but Leeds not being able to make any big chances. Leeds' best opportunities seemed to come exclusively from winning corners, of which one corner led to every person in Elland Road, except ones dressed in black, not noticing a handball by a Sunderland player. As the half carried on, Sunderland retreated deeper and deeper, making it even more difficult for Leeds to make chances. Fark made a number of subs around the 80th minute in an attempt to nick a goal, to no effect, and in the end the game ended in what was arguably a fair 0-0 bore draw. I was really struggling to write this earlier, like I felt like I'd missed something, but I really don't feel like I did, considering when watching the game.
No, I mean, yeah, there were so few chances, as we're going to get to discuss, so yeah, there wasn't a great deal to talk about in terms of incident, other than refereeing incident, really, which is not really our style, so yeah, that's hard work.
Yeah, I don't think we need to say anything on that ref decision. Yeah. It speaks for itself, doesn't it?
I think it does, yeah. Yeah.
Let's start off with Farrakh's comments post-match then. So what he said was that the most disappointing and the only disappointing thing was not testing Patterson. It was the only reason why we didn't win this game. Is that a fair assessment, Dan, or is there more to it?
It's kind of right that we didn't test Patterson, but the reason we didn't test Patterson isn't because our attack wasn't functioning well enough. So he's kind of right, but it needs to go a step further and saying, yeah, we didn't test Patterson enough and that's on us because we didn't, you know, open them up well enough and create situations where we're able to get clean shots away, which was the big problem in this game. So it's kind of fair, but it's kind of, he needs to just go a step further and take some responsibility perhaps for the tactical setup or his inability to kind of tweak things to kind of open them up, I would say.
Is there anything in the way Sunderland approached this match about why we couldn't test the keeper more?
Yeah, so obviously I came away very frustrated from the game and I watched it, you know, I've said this before that your view of the game changes when you watch it back a day later, kind of soberly. I wasn't drunk, but, you know, like as a non-fan, analytically, I suppose. And I've come away from the second watch kind of thinking, well, it's as much credit to Sunderland as it was a bad Leeds performance. You're all coming away being grumpy and grumbling about Rutter's performance or whatever, or, you know, or Grover Kamara not doing enough to open the game up or whatever. But actually, I was quite impressed with Sunderland's kind of dedication to the defensive block, really. I thought it was almost like a perfect example of how to stop Leeds playing and how to stop Leeds from creating things, and they did that. I mean, they had to sacrifice completely their own attacking game to do that, but they all feel justified in that they got a point. So, for example, there was one time where there was the shot where in the first half where someone put Bamford through and he got past the keeper and then kind of shot across the goal and it went quite wide and then Jorginho picked the ball up on the right-hand side just outside the box. If you freeze frame the game at the footage at that point, every single Sunderland player is down behind Jorginho. So we've had a breakthrough, we've shot, someone's picked the ball up and by the time that our follow-up players pick the ball up, all their players are in the box and blocking the shot.
Yeah.
So it's just that absolute, and that's including Bellingham, who was their kind of, you know, nominal centre forward. He was back and behind Rutter at that point, who was one of our second strikers. So they're just completely and utterly committed to the bit of getting back and blocking the box. I was looking at some of the numbers, the passing numbers and stuff. This was we only had 3 completed passes into the Sunderland penalty box in the whole game. That's the second worst or second lowest number for Leeds this season. The lowest being the Hull away game, where we're down to 10 men for a chunk. Yet we had quite a lot of passes into the final third, so we progressed the ball quite well in this game into the final third. But then, obviously, Sunderland were so well like committed to, you know, they were happy for us to progress the ball into the final third, but then block the box and stop us from shooting. So it's kind of like they were committed to just dropping into shape, not tackling us really. I mean, I don't know, you know, they weren't diving in. If Somerville or James got on the ball kind of towards the edge of the box, they would just hold them up until the bodies got behind back, you know, got behind in behind them and filled the gaps in. So it was just very much a very disciplined, hold leads up, get bodies back, and block a shot and off they go. So kind of credit to Sunderland, really. It's just the only problem with that kind of game plan is it really completely and utterly stifles your own attack. They didn't have any, I mean, they had very little counter-attack threat, a couple of moments from Clark. So, you know, that's fine for them when they're having a bad run to turn around a bad run, but that's it.
Yeah, I completely agree with all that. And I had a look at the XG numbers as well before we came on. That backs up everything you've said. So Leeds had an XG of 0.55, which I believe is our lowest this year, or it's definitely our bottom two if it's not. And Sunderland only created 0.24 XG, so not a lot to shout home about on this one.
Yeah,
but yeah, I completely agree with what you've said. I think Sunderland came, their plan was just to not concede, and I think that's fine in a sense, but with Farke's comments, he and Leeds have got to be doing more to make more chances. Like, it felt very predictable what they were trying to do. It was just funneling it down to Somerville. Hope he does something. Rutter was on that side as well. Bamford was on that side as well.
Yeah.
So Dan James was stood on the... He may have been, sat in the West Stand in the first half because he didn't really contribute anything.
Yeah, it's one of those games where like attacks go to diary Dan James, don't they? It was one of those games... Really, it's really frustrating. Just going back to the XG point, yeah, this was our second lowest XG generated according to FBRF, 0.5. We generated 0.4 against Birmingham when we lost to them at the start of the season, early on.
Oh, I had the pleasure of going to that game as well.
Yeah, look at you. And our third worst actually was Sunderland away, 0.6. So they've done us twice, really, on that front. So credit to them, really. They've got a number in that respect.
Well, we won't have to face them in the playoffs, so that's fine.
That's true.
Daniel Jonesy on Twitter asked, so is there something wider going on, is basically his point. So is it young players feeling the pressure? Is it tactical stubbornness by Farke? And why is he not making full use of the squad to change games?
I mean, on the whole pressure thing and like players bottling it and stuff, I think that's really hard to know as an outsider. Unless, you know, if players are making calamity decisions and really clearly, obviously, feeling the pressure and breaking down, you know, Liam Cooper and Berardi versus Derby in the playoffs. Sorry, everybody. That's like an obvious... You can say that's the pressure getting to someone, can't you? Or you can... It feels very much like that's the case. Watching this game, this wasn't like players kicking the ball, making mistakes, arguing with each other. It wasn't a calamitous. I mean, Leeds defended really well, actually, and Leeds had a clear plan and executed it. I didn't like the plan, but they executed probably the plan that Farke wanted, or to a large extent. So I don't think it's pressure or... It's not overly. It's really hard to say that it's definitely is pressure. Tactical stubbornness, yeah, and lack of changes in game. I mean, I feel like Farke's got this team playing this way, and if teams are prepared to pack the box and stop us from shooting and don't engage in us and don't let us generate those transitions and generate space to operate in, then they're going to stop us. So it's stubbornness and a lack of imagination from Farke and the coaching team or the players in the pitch to kind of change up and play a different way. I mean, it's in some games this season when we've struggled, we've gone a bit longer, and that's been an effective way of sort of breaking these sort of teams down and gone more direct. I kind of, on the watch back, I kind of felt like we could have gone more direct a bit here and perhaps and switched play a bit more and played the ball into the corners a bit more and tried to turn Sunderland around. But so, yeah, I think it's tactical stubbornness and lacks tactical flexibility. And, yeah, I think there's a bit of that from Farke, and I do think he's very slow to make changes. I'd like to understand if that was true at Norwich when he was manager there, because like he's slow to bring Nonto on, and he rates Nonto. I think he thinks Nonto is a better player than Dan James when he's fit.
Yeah,
I think so. It's not that he doesn't rate Nonto. It's not that he doesn't rate Perrault, because he used him for the first half of the season, and Perrault was largely okay or fairly good, scored some good goals. So he clearly rates Joseph and just gives him 10 minutes. So I don't think it's a lack of trust in those players, particularly the ones I've just named, because they're senior players, aren't they? They're good football players. And Farke would agree with you there. I think it's just he has a plan, and I think it's stubbornness to change from his plan probably more than kind of like lack of trust or lack of trust beyond the kind of key 18 players or whatever it is.
I think it's also a case of that he trusts the players that are out there to execute his plan and that eventually it'll work. So it's like, I guess I could see it from one way that Dan James... If Dan James is doing everything he should be doing, to hook him then at half time or 60 minutes is a bit harsh on him.
Yeah.
Because he's like, well, I'm doing what you told me to do. Why am I going off for Nonto? Whereas I thought it was pretty evident in that first half that we needed Nonto on to just.
Yeah.
The ball wasn't going to Dan James, and if it did, it was going to die, and he just would offer something different. If we were going to all build up on the left hand side, we may as well get Nonto coming over here as well and just like do like a double team on them, or like just even occupy those like right half spaces. So yeah, it's, I don't think it's that he doesn't trust them, but he just, the plan that he goes with, he's so convinced that it's right. I hate doing like a comparison to Bielsa, but Bielsa was the same as like, if plan A doesn't work, do plan A better. And Farke's almost a bit like that until he gets to the 80th minute, and then he's like, let's just bomb it. Let's put six attackers on and bomb on. So
I think most managers are that way. How many teams do you know that are completely not to change the start of the play or change things up mid game? I mean, they might have a shape change or they might have a different profile of player to sort of interpret the instructions differently. But you know, there are very few managers that can really, really tactically tweak a game, completely change the way a team plays to like win a game. So it's kind of unusual. It's kind of unusual. Request, isn't it, to expect that of a manager? There's not many that can do that. Bielsa could make subtle changes, couldn't he, to change games? We saw it now and again, but fans still grumbled about him not doing that enough, and you know, not rotating enough. So I just feel like you've got to remember that like Sunderland were very good defensively here, and no matter what we were doing, they were kind of handling. And it's sometimes you've just got to give the opposition credit. Now, Leeds, like Farke's had a good season. Leeds have had a good season. You know, we're going to finish in above 90 points. You can't grumble at that, really. So Farke's got like some justification for sticking with his plan. And you know, Sunderland came with a really difficult game plan and executed it excellently. You know, credit to them. If I was a Sunderland coach and I told them to play the way they played, I'd be delighted because they've carried out the coach's the coach's instructions probably to a T from what I can see. So sometimes you just got to say, yeah, we came up against a really good opposition, they had a really clear game plan to stop us, and they did it well. And you know,
yeah, I think this game actually, like, I still think a lot of Leeds fans and sort of wider football fans as well that follow the Championship, that Leeds are actually a defensive first team, really, with great individual attackers. Yeah. And we did a great, if you look at it in a positive way, we did a great defensive performance in this game. We gave up basically no chances. Yeah. It's just that our individuals didn't create those chances. So it's not actually that different to what we've seen since the turn of the year, really. It's just that the individuals didn't click today to an extent.
Yeah, you've kind of stolen the point I was going to make, that Leeds, because I think this is the point I was making at the start, that I've missed some games, but it sounds like we've abandoned that defence, or we've not been defensively strong recently.
No.
So it felt like this was a step back for Leeds to be very solid again. And it was noticeable in the game that quite often challenging Bellingham, the Sunderland forward, was Gruev, and we were leaving centre-halves behind Gruev to mop up. So we were kind of being quite defensive in ourselves. You know, Grover was almost acting as the first centre-back dealing with their forward, meaning that our centre-backs could handle their wingers who were kind of coming in field, and we also had the full-backs tucking around. So Leeds were quite cautious. You know, how often did you see, with the exception of maybe the last 10 minutes, how often did you see both full-backs flying forward? I mean, not often.
But Archie Gray didn't get the ball most of the game.
He didn't, no. And to be fair to Sunderland, that I was... Obviously, it was on the night, like, the fans were getting really like grumpy with Rodon mostly, and a little bit with Melier for not getting the ball out to the right. I was looking for that on the watch back, and to be fair to Clark did a really good job blocking that lane, and the left centre back and left wing back were really pushing high as well. So I think they were looking for high turnovers. They probably thought that their best chance of a goal was probably from a high turnover on their left side, our right side. So I think there was an element of, you know, Dan James isn't the most secure player on our receiving the ball in our attacking zone. If we mark Archie Gray, we can pressure Dan James and get a turnover type thing. So I think to some extent, there's that safety first element in Leeds in the way we were defending was there, but also in our build up, we were like, well, we can't play right because they're going to get, you know, if they break, they're breaking with Clark. So there's an element of that as well, I think, which I think obviously a lot of people were really frustrated about the left side of bias, but I think that's probably the reason for that as well.
Yeah, I was with my dad and my brother at this game, and I was saying to them that I think we're so shit scared of Jack Clark that we're just kind of saying if we don't put the ball down that side, they can't attack down that side. I think that was part of it, that they just, if the ball's on the left, Leeds is left, then there's quite a lot of stuff has to go on for Jack Clark to be on the ball one-on-one against Archie Gray. So
yep.
I think that was part of it, why we just didn't use that side at all. If anything, you saw go direct to Dan James and just skip out Archie Gray altogether most of the time.
And the thing is, Archie Gray actually did okay defensively against Jack Clark, didn't he? But definitely, the only time Sunderland were aggressive defensively was on when we did try and build down that left side, which is partly why I think Nonto would have been a better choice for this game than Dan James, because you can play into him, can't you? And he is technically secure. Like, he's probably the best of our wingers, isn't he? Like, receiving and turning infield and, you know, retaining possession, probably. Yeah. So, you know, Nonto is that kind of inside right might have worked better actually in this game, and perhaps we could have then played up to Nonto in that kind of right channel and maybe built from there, but, you know.
Yeah, I can only assume Nonto wasn't fit to start a game yet. I think he's been almost rushed back a bit from injury.
Yeah, there was one point where I don't know if you noticed, he kind of limped. And I thought, oh, no, he's done his hamstring.
Yeah.
I think it was like down the right hand side in front of Fark, down that kind of, or in front of the away fans, perhaps just down there. And I think he might have just been tackled hard and he limped a bit and then he seemed okay after that. But I did worry for a minute that he pulled his hammy at me.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the game. So
enough negatives for a second then. So was there anything that Leeds did do well in this game? So I've kind of said the defence, but is there anything outside of that we can say?
Well, defence, and I thought we turned the ball over quite well in midfield. So we
yeah.
Like, so on the ball, I wasn't particularly all that happy with Grove and Kamara. But in terms of like winning the ball and getting the ball turned and kind of being physically dominant, I thought they had quite a good game in that respect. I think the whole team did in that respect. I thought we won it quite well in turn. It was just like the way we broke from those turnovers was bad. So yeah, I just thought like defensively, generally speaking, in terms of like ingression in the challenge and the tackle was quite good. You know, we were quite dominant physically, weren't we? We came out of 50-50s on top more often, I thought. I mean, perhaps that's partly to do with Sunderland's, they were just dropping off and blocking space rather than looking to challenge us too hard. But yeah, I thought we battled physically quite well, and like watching the game back, it felt like we were quite sharp and aggressive. You know, it wasn't that the players weren't going into challenges and trying and, you know, and putting themselves around in this game. So yeah, I would just say that. Bamford's hold-up play was okay. Nothing else was good about Bamford's performance, but I thought his back-to-goal game was okay. I thought we played the ball into him and he held it quite well and held Ballard off. I mean, to be fair, is it Ballard the centre-back? Yeah, Ballard, he probably should have been sent off, and I thought that was kind of credit to Bamford for kind of engaging him in quite a smart way and making him play quite physically. So, you know, on another day, we could have got Ballard sent off and we could have had like a bit of a platform to build on. So kind of physically, the team were good.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got anything to add on the positives there. I think you've covered anything else that I was happy to say. I don't think, apart from that, it was a very positive performance, really. Are we concerned about our like interplay and build-up on lack of repeatable patterns after watching this game? So, like we've said, we were very left-sided heavy. And, I guess that's where we had most of the joy in this game, but that might not even be true. It just might have been the ball was there the most.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem, but it's been a problem all season, the lack of repeatable patterns. We're a team that likes like that thrives on chaos and transition. So if the game opens up and we've got space to move into, then we're great, aren't we? And we're a dangerous team. And that's been true all season. We've not been a team that can like pin a team in and then rotate them around and kind of fashion an opening with a rehearsed move. That's not the sort of team we are. This season, perhaps that'll come in season two under Fark, I don't know. But what frustrated me more was we didn't move them around enough, we didn't switch play enough. Like, I wanted a bit more direct play, so I thought, like, Gourav and Kamara were very safe, weren't they? And that's part of probably Fark's instruction about being safe. But Gourav's got a good long ball in him. Like, there were quite a few occasions when it looked like a big switch to Dan James was on. Like, get Dan James in the corner chasing the ball, turn them round, switch back again. You know, just get them going side to side a bit more, perhaps. You know, it doesn't have to be too sophisticated, but just get the, like, you know, play quicker and director into the corners and turn it that way. So it's kind of more not about the repeatable patterns, because we're not going to see them now, like with four games to go. That's like a pre-season thing, isn't it, really? But just a bit more variety in the way we attack them, and perhaps going a bit more direct at times might have opened them up a bit and perhaps got them running a bit more something, and maybe tied them out some more, and, you know, perhaps had them more leggy late in the game. I don't know. So yeah, that's my concern, rather than repeatable patterns, because it's just they ain't gonna come, are they, this time? Yeah. That's something for next season, really, for the pre-season. But yeah, just lack of variety.
Yeah. One thing that Adam has kindly noted in the running order, which we maybe could talk about at this point, was the fact that we bypassed the midfield quite a lot, particularly in the first half. And there was also Rodon and Ampadu sort of ball carrying and passing out from the back. He's put that Rodon was passing it in a Strauch-like way into the forward areas, and then Ampadu was playing hero ball, which didn't pay off as much. So anything you want to add on sort of our general build-up patterns?
I think there was an obvious ploy to kind of play those kind of almost like Red Bull balls into the, you know, them kind of up back and through balls that we used to see the Jesse Marsh team play. So the centre back playing it up to like one of the centre forwards, and then so up to Bamford in this case, or Ritter, and then like laying it off to one of our wingers. There was a bit of that. There was an attempt at that, I think, in the game. They kind of worked to an extent. It got us into, like I said before, it kind of got us into the final third, but we didn't seem to have the ability to turn it into a a shot or a chance. So there was obviously like a clear pattern to, or a clear option to try and play it between the lines and get between their midfield lines into the feet of our forwards and then try and turn them from there. It just didn't quite happen, I guess. I think it was probably as much to do with Sunderland's like speed at getting back into a block. They were so quick to get back into a block. I mean, really, really super quick. So yeah, I think there was obviously an attempt to play between the lines, and had Sunderland stepped out and played a bit more, that tactic might have worked quite well. But they just had so many bodies around us. So Bamford would hold Ballard off and lay it off to somebody. But as soon as, say, Somerville picked the ball up off him in the left channel, there'd be two players on Somerville and, you know, everybody else was back into shape. So he wasn't able to go anywhere.
Yeah, I think from sort of build-up side for me is that you can tell that Ampadu is kind of getting a bit annoyed at the lack of movement in front of him, and he's sort of trying to make something happen, which is, I don't want to say like Jansen-like, but sometimes he does it and he definitely overdoes it, and I do find it a bit annoying. But yeah, I thought Rodon's passing was pretty good in this point, so like, look, that was probably a positive we could have mentioned actually. But
yeah,
I definitely think we miss Strouk in games like this, who he can play those more progressive passes better than Ampadu and Rodon can, and it just might help us to move about a defence, like you said earlier.
I think so, yeah. I mean, Strike's a big miss in a few reasons. I mean, set pieces as well, attacking set pieces. In these, you know, we had a lot of corners in this game, didn't we? Now, we ain't scoring a corner unless Strike's in the team, are we? So
yeah.
So I want him back for two reasons, you know, for his passing, but also for his set piece threat.
I don't even get excited when we get corners anymore.
No. it's mad how like Rodon's good in the air, like a great box defender, clears the ball. Like, I'm happy him defending corners, but attacking corners, I mean, he's like proper 50p head, isn't he? It's just a waste of time.
Yeah. I think that covers everything on a tactical side then. So I will go for a ad break before we do the second half of the analysis. But before that, we will plug the patron. Don't worry, patrons, you don't have to listen to this part. Our patrons get access for as little as £1.99 a month, which gives you ad-free podcasts. And if you want to pay a little more, you get other benefits, including early access to our preview pods, analysis articles, videos, and bonus podcasts. If you want to find out more about the patron, please visit patreon.com/ASAW patron.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's move on to the player focus section then. So, unfortunately, Martin isn't here to answer this question, so you're going to have to do it for me. Are we too reliant on Rutter and Somerville to make something out of nothing?
Yes. But we had Nonto, who was performing at those levels back before the international break. So we had three players, and that was fine. And Bamford was performing pretty well, and Dan James was contributing. So at the moment, we're relying on Rutter and Somerville. Hopefully, Nonto's back soon, and perhaps we rotate Bamford out of the question for later. So, yeah, if we can get Nonto back, I feel like we've got a triple threat rather than a double threat. And then if you have that, you know, if you have that, then Dan James is just like a nice weapon off the bench, isn't he? So, yes, it's true, that's true, but, you know, it could be worse. Like, also two of the best players in the league, so.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think with Somerville, you kind of saw against Watford and Hull that he's one of those definitely not feeling the pressure, if any of them are. And he will step up and sort of, he can make the chances even in games where there's like nothing going. So I'm not really worried about being reliant on Somerville. I am a little bit concerned about the reliance on Rutter to create chances, because he has definitely recently, I don't know if he might have been doing it all season, but I've just noticed it more recently, just like tends to hold onto the ball, tends to just want to beat a man almost for like the sake of it, and I feel like one of those sort of like dars in the cop now. But like he has been getting to me a bit, and it's also the way he plays. It kind of leads to Leeds losing the ball, and then the ball gets turned over. So I think he's obviously for the level, he's a great player and he's a great chance creator. But I think that longer term, I think right wing was where I'd want him, and I'd want a proper 10.
I agree with that. I mean, I think if we go up, we need to move him. Yeah, onto the right wing. And hopefully with that extra space to kind of create from there, he'll still be effective. I mean, as one of those Dars from the North Stand, and the Dars that I go to the game with absolutely do grumble about Rutter holding on to it too long. No matter how many times I'm saying, like, look, guys, he's the most creative player we've got. Like, you have to take it. Kind of, you have to just deal with it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a funny game for him. Like, he got a lot of criticism and kind of fair enough, but he was the only guy that was, like, receiving the ball and turning and breaking lines or beating a man in the sort of central areas on Tuesday. Now, nothing came off for him. You know, his final action was terrible. But he was the only guy that was kind of like creating anything with dynamic movement in the central areas on Tuesday still. So despite him having a bad game, he was still probably our best central attacking player, which is probably a low bar at the moment. But so, yeah, I just feel like we just get off his back, really, and just you have to just take the rough of this move. Yes, you're right. He does hold on to it too long. He doesn't. Sometimes I wish he'd, you know, release it a bit earlier or a touch earlier. And his shooting, you know, leaves a lot to be desired.
Less said, but the better.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when he sees like his highlight reels from Hoffenheim, he looks like he like wallops a ball in, doesn't he? Like a great finisher. So I wonder what it is. Anyway, so it's just one of those games, wasn't it? Where obviously the box is packed. He's not a quick shooter. He's not like a guy that gets his shots off quickly, is he, in any way by nature? So it's just not a game that would suit him, really, on Tuesday. Like, watching the game back, I was fairly happy with his general kind of... Like, I didn't look at him thinking he's knackered or he's injured still or he's moving okay. You know, he looked to me moving okay. Probably just needs a goal, doesn't he, just to get confident enough.
I think the only other thing I noticed that he was definitely... Because we were so dominant on the left, he was playing in the left... like the left half space as it was as well, which, yeah, it just felt like there wasn't any space for him there, for one. But maybe if he could have sort of stayed more central, more to the right, it might have just helped stretch out Sunderland a bit more in this one. But I guess if you're the most creative player in the team, then you go and kind of follow the ball, which is also fair enough.
Yeah,
let's talk about the wide dynamics a bit then. So what do you think was wrong with Dan James in this one? The right was obviously used a lot less than the left, but he struggled whenever he did get the ball, and he hasn't really performed since he missed that penalty for Wales, I'd say, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's definitely like a confidence thing with him, or no, I can't say definite because I don't know, I'm not inside his head, but you do wonder if there's a confidence issue with him, because his touch looks to be a bit off, he looks to be a little bit less decisive. Like when he was playing at his best, he was just very single-minded, wasn't he? The ball comes to my feet, I go, cross it, whatever. You know, just have it. He has that kind of very single-minded game. The problem is with this game, he was like, I felt he was coming in field too much and trying to get involved in build-up, and that's just not what he's good at, even when he's playing
well.
He's
not good at that at all.
No, and even when he's playing well, he's not good at that. Like, Dan James, you just want him high and wide and, like, you know, and give him things to chase, like a dog chasing a car or something. And that's what he's good at, just play to his strengths, and we didn't play to his strengths. So if you're going to ask your right winger to come in field and combine and get involved in build up, then like play Dan James. Play Willy Nonto, or bring Somerville over and play Anthony on the left, or play Rutter on the right and just say play make off the right. You know, just do it differently.
Somerville on the right is something I would potentially be interested in similar games like this, and Anthony on the left, just as something different, even if it's not to start.
Exactly.
Just like, to change.
I'll try Rutter on the right, because he's going to be drifting in field a lot anyway, so he's going to kind of pick up those kind of number 10 positions anyway off the right, and he could kind of do what Farke like Boyan did to do all those years back at Norwich, can kind of pick up those positions. So yeah, I mean, if Nonto's fit, then just put Nonto back there, it's fine. And it was looking good, wasn't it, with Nonto and Somerville either side of Rutter before the international break. That was working pretty well. So just go back to that. But yeah, if we can't leave Dan James high and wide and attacking the touchline like he's good at, then don't play him at all. Play him to strengths.
Yeah. If we were going to go into Dan James's head, as you said at the start, I imagine it's just a chimp running around really fast, like on like a hamster wheel, potentially.
Yeah, just like
that's what I'm imagining.
Hitting a cymbal.
Yeah, but like also running at full pelt the whole time.
And hitting a wall now and again. Yeah.
I think we're going to have to talk about the elephant in the room then, which is Patrick Bamford. So Jamie asked, what kind of impact do you think Matteo Joseph could make if he started over Bamford?
So I think what Bamford, I've said it already, but what Bamford did well is his hold-up game was pretty good. And I think Joseph probably doesn't have quite that good a hold-up game yet, but I imagine Joseph will develop that in time. He's similar kind of build, isn't he? And he seems like a competitive, physical kind of guy. I think what Joseph gives you that you don't have with Bamford is, I think Joseph's got legs, hasn't he, that Bamford doesn't no longer has, which is a shame,
because yeah.
Bamford was good. So I think he'll run the channels more, and he'll you can play through balls and he'll more likely get onto them or get closer to them or force the opposition to make a mistake. And I think also in the penalty box, I think he's way sharper than Bamford. Joseph is more likely to like just get on the end of, you know, a scruffy bouncing ball in the box,
yeah.
and he took it away. You know, he's more of an instinctive kind of penalty box striker as well, so he's more likely to just pick up that scruffy goal, isn't he, than Bamford is. So, yeah, it's kind of running channels, linking play, and then, you know, and just being in the six-yard box when there are balls flashing across the box, which Bamford doesn't seem to do, Rutter doesn't seem to do. So we could kind of do with that, really. You know, is the kind of cliched football dar, like fox in the box, isn't he?
Yeah.
Joseph a bit. He's got an element of that about him. So, yeah, I just feel like, get him in there now for me. I feel like Bamford looks tired, looks lacking in confidence. I mean, that shot he played in the first half that like almost went out for throwing when he got around the keeper. I mean, he was trying to play across goal, but it was terrible. I mean, just hit it hard and low across the goal line and hope it.
Yeah, I was in the cheese bed, but I couldn't really work out what happened, but I knew it was bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm just to the right of the goal in the cop, and he was like literally in front of me, and it was quite a good position. I was just like, hit it towards the goal line and hope it gets a ricochet. And he tries to square. I don't know what he tries to do, but he looked like a player lacking in confidence. You know, it wasn't a lack of effort. He was pressing was okay. Like I said, back to goal stuff was okay. It wasn't they did nothing for the team, and it wasn't a disaster class. He just didn't offer any kind of really like any kind of pace threat or kind of nuisance threat in behind, which I think might have. You know, turn them around and help make space for the Rutter and those kind of guys. So yeah, I definitely would start Joseph.
I would as well, and I think you almost see the best of Bamford when he's like either dropped or basically on the verge of being dropped. Whereas if he knows he's going to start, I always feel like when Nketiah got those couple of games, you then suddenly saw. Well, I think it was like Nketiah was going to start against Birmingham for when the centenary game.
Yeah,
and then he got injured, then suddenly Bamford goes on a run of like six games. Then Nketiah gets those games around Christmas, and then suddenly Bamford's good again. It's like Augustin comes in, Bamford's suddenly good again. It's like he kind of thrives on the competition almost, whereas he doesn't seem to have that at the moment.
I remember the promotion year, Nketiah played against West Brom away just before Christmas.
Yeah.
And Leeds really struggled in that game, and it was almost like Bamford came on and showed what he did for the team that a Bielsa team that Nketiah couldn't do, like link up and the pressing, the hold up playing stuff. It's almost like, yeah, in those situations, like Bamford's great, isn't he? So I think we need a bit of Bamford out of the team. Like, just give him a week off, let him refresh mentally, whatever. You know,
yeah.
There's been a lot of pressure on him. Bamford's been a big part of Leeds being good in 2024. He's been a key part of that. We shouldn't forget that. But at the same time, like, he's on a downward slope at the moment, so just give him a break. Give Joseph a run. I mean, you know, against Blackburn. I mean, I thought Perreault did okay as well when he came off the bench the other day. He looked like he had some nice touches and looked quite secure. You know, he was in close to making scoring goals, wasn't he, at Coventry? Well, he missed a big chance, but he was like, you know, he's getting it on the end of things, isn't he, again? So, you know,
yeah.
Give Perreault a run, by all means. You know, just change it up, I think, at the moment. It just feels like a change-up situation.
One thing that Will noticed was the direct balls over the top again, which Bamford getting in behind, and he's like, he's getting to those balls, but like the version of Pat that now exists just struggles when he gets those openings because he can't seem to get away from defenders or outpace them, which, like, that was kind of a trademark of Ben Bamford at his best, wasn't it? That like if there was a bit, he would get that separation. And I always feel like in that Premier League season, when he was like in the sort of left, he was approaching the goal from the left, and he had that separation from a defender, and he'd shoot across. And now he gets in those positions now, and he can't shake the defender off, so he can't get the shot off. So he's just, yeah, his body doesn't let him do those anymore. So maybe it's just like, and then like a defender's probably not worried about him going behind anymore. So if he could put someone like Joseph in, that he might keep that separation, might just stretch the defence a bit more in a game like this.
I think so. I think Joseph, he can get that space and get a shot away, can't he? Is it quicker at getting his shots away? He's obviously more athletic, he's a younger, like quicker guy. So yeah, absolutely certain. Yeah, I mean, the chances you're talking about in the Premier League, straight away I think of Leicester away in the lockdown season.
Yeah, that's the same one I think of as
well. Yeah, really nice ball across his left and he just hit it. And that was a classic Bamford goal. And that first Premier League, that lockdown season was built on those kind of Bamford goals, wasn't it? A lot of it was. But yeah, he can't do that anymore. And I feel like Joseph could, like we've said, get that separation and get some shots away. Like, I don't think Joseph's like an amazing technical player or a wonderful like technical footballer, but I just feel like he's the kind of guy who's going to do anything to get a shot away and absolutely kill himself to get a shot off on goal. And that's what we could do for the moment.
Yeah. Did anyone else struggle in this game that we haven't mentioned? And if so, what were their issues for you?
Well, I kind of said it before, Gruev and Kamara, and I thought they actually had pretty tidy games. Like, they didn't, the passing was fine. Well, they kind of dominate the physical battles. They won the ball well. We kind of controlled the central spaces quite well. But I was really frustrated with how not one of them felt like big switches or looked to like play the ball right. If you look at the pass maps, like you'll see the balls going right from like the centre mids. There's hardly any. So they were passing left. I mean, it's mostly down to Ampadu and Rodon that were going down the left. But to some extent, I thought like Kamara and Grove should have taken hold of the game and thought, right, we need to kind of distribute the ball more here and we need to like work it right as well and just kind of vary it up a bit. And that frustrated me. So it wasn't that they played badly, but there should have been someone in their ear saying, like, you've got to get the ball right. You've got to, like, you know, you've got to get the ball going side to side some more.
Yeah.
So that frustrated me. But that's perhaps more tactical than like a performance thing, because I don't think they physically did anything wrong, if that makes sense. They just weren't doing what I wanted them to do on a tactical level. I just felt like they could have forced it more that way.
Yeah, I think this is like a wider point for Kamara and Gruev that I think the players were doing what they were supposed to be doing. So like there was a pass at some point that went out to Archie Gray and the whole crowd went and cheered.
Ironic.
And I actually felt really bad for the players because I don't think it was them. They weren't just like ignoring Gray going, oh, we're not giving it to that 18-year-old over there. Like, I think they had been told to do that. So yeah, I think this is more on the FARC, the struggles there as well. One thing I'll add on Kamara is I think his ball carrying is good. And in a game like this, if he can carry the ball and he can break lines, that is another thing that creates chances. So he did it a couple of times in the first half and then I didn't see it again, which was a shame because I think it could have been something that might have made the difference.
Yeah, there was one moment, wasn't there, where he won the ball on the ground and kind of held onto it and got up and turned and little bit of play. It was quite a good little bit of play. And I think, I might be mistaken, and this is something for someone who watches Scottish football, but I think when he played at Rangers and had like a 4-3-3, he was the guy that carried the ball and was the press-resistant guy that got up the pitch for them.
Right, okay.
So I was expecting more of that. I might be wrong on that one, but I was kind of expecting a bit more of that from Kamara. But he's been tidy. I like Kamara. I think he's a good football player. I do think he's probably told to be kind of cautious by Farke. You know, it's a very much a double pivot, isn't it, with two defensive-minded midfield players. There. You know, there's... I mean, in terms of profiles, I would probably prefer... I'd like to see Archie Gray in there because I think his natural instinct is to turn out of trouble, isn't it, and carry the ball and take it forward.
Yeah.
So I think we might have a more balanced skill set if Gray was in there with Gruev, for example. You know, it might balance out a bit better. But I don't see that changing anytime soon, which is a shame because I think Roberts at right back would be fine as well. It'd be decent as well. So anyway.
Yeah, I think he potentially might carry more attacking threat from that position than Gray does.
Yeah, he's a traditional right back, isn't he? So he might overlap and his crossing's probably better than Gray's. So I don't think Gray's a particularly great crosser, is he? He's a centre mid, so you wouldn't expect him to be necessarily. So yeah, I just feel like it could be tweaked up. We could see Gray moving to centre mid, get Roberts out there, you know, look to spread the play left and right a bit more from those guys, and it might help a little bit. It might just help like the shape. It might help shape the opposition how we want them to make space for the better players to do their thing.
Yeah. Let's end on something more positive then. So who was man of the match for you in this game?
I mean, like Ampadu and Rodon were really dominant again, weren't they? I mean, the only time Sunderland ever looked like any dangerous was like in a counter break with Jack Clark going off the right. And we kind of dealt with that pretty well. So I just thought they were very, very dominant. I know everyone's grumbling about like them passing left, but they were just super dominant. So those two, I thought Firpo and Somerville did okay in like combining and, you know, causing a bit of a threat, but that's it, really. I'm struggling.
Yeah. I'd add Firpo to that. I thought Firpo had a good game.
Yeah.
I thought he, in the first half, probably more so, that he got on, got to the byline, got a chance into the box. Maybe he didn't do the best with them. And then defensively, I don't think he had any issues. So I think he had a pretty solid game.
He was very dominant, wasn't he? Physically dominant. I've noticed that in this league, that Firpo.
I sat in the East Stand for one game. Yeah, I sat in the East Stand for one game on like the second row. And I had Firpo right in front of me. I was like, you're actually a unit, but like, I couldn't tell it until I was really close to him. Like, he's a proper unit and like, definitely physically dominant.
Yeah, in this, I mean, I've noticed this in general in the championship, the kind of you know, Premier League players are bigger guys, aren't they, than Championship players?
Yeah.
And Firpo's a Premier League player, isn't he, really, in build at least?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he can dominate here, like in the Premier League, he wouldn't. So I do notice it in, like, challenges and 50-50s, he can ride it, can't he, and break out. And, you know, he's been good, hasn't he, recently? I mean, let's not get too carried away, it's Firpo, but he has been good recently.
Yeah. Right, one last thing. So this is going to be probably a bit easier than it would have been had Ipswich won last night, but we're going to do a second call for calm. Now, I'm not sure I agreed with the first call for calm, but we'll go with it anyway. So, Dan, we had Martin and Adam call for calm on the last review, and this had the potential to be a real doom pod after disappointing drop points, until Ipswich drew 0-0 with Watford, and now suddenly we're a point closer to Leicester and the same gap to Ipswich we were prior to both games. Where are we at, in your view? Should we still be confident? Should we be panicking? We just need to better one of their results now in the next four. So is there any need to panic?
There's no need to panic whatsoever. The game on Tuesday was like Leeds' good defence was back. That's a good thing. A lot of our good form in 2024 was built on that, our good defence is back, you know, conceding zero or occasionally one goal. If we get back to that, all we need to do is like score a goal and we win. It's the whole kind of Kenny Jackett ones and zeros thing. It felt like a little bit like we're getting back to that on Tuesday. So if we can get our noses in front against Blackburn, I would be confident of keeping them out and winning, you know, going on to getting a second goal. If we can get our noses in front at QPR away, I'd be confident of winning. I think Borough is a good style matchup for us because they'll play. Borough won't, particularly at home. Now, Borough, good team, they're on form. They've got some good players. They've got a lot of players I like at Borough, actually. And I think Carrick's an interesting manager. But they give the opposition chances. You know, they're not a good defensive team. So, again, that suits us. We could physically dominate them and hit them on the break. So, potentially, Borough's a good style matchup, even though they're playing well. I can see us getting two wins and a draw, and it being down to the last game. That's how I see it. And it feels like a 50-50 coin flip when you get to that situation. That's all right. Ask me in September if I'd take that. I'd be like, oh, yeah. So,
yeah, but I think anyone would in that, really, wouldn't you? Just the context of the last few months, which would maybe say you wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, before the international break, we were the best team in this division. Like, no question. Not no question, but we were probably the best team in this division, you know? Or we were the top two. Us and Leicester were clearly the best two teams in the division. Like, Ipswich were kind of hanging on, weren't they, annoyingly? But I don't think anyone objectively would say they were as good as Leeds or Leicester. It looks like Leicester and Ipswich are having a flaky time, a little bit like we are at the moment, which is good. So it means that it's a good time to have a flaky moment because they are as well. So we're not losing anything, are we? So, you know, a good win against Blackburn on Saturday and everyone's like chipper as anything and we're away out again, aren't we? It's going to be last day, isn't it? And, you know, we're going to have a Bristol Rovers situation, aren't we, back in 2010 when Max Gradle got sent off. Who's Max Gradle? Who's getting sent off for us? That's the question.
Dan James.
Do you think Dan James? I was thinking Firpo. Couple of clumsy yellows.
No, because he's always on the yellow, so he's quite good at not getting a second yellow because he never gets sent off.
Yeah, or Bamford's going to miss. Bamford's Bamford's going to miss a big chance, isn't he?
Well, yeah, that's the path of the course, isn't it?
Yeah, the disco. No, I'm fairly confident. I think I've got a feeling it's going to go down to last game, and it'll be in our hands on last game. It'll be like, don't, you know, win the game, we go up type thing, and it's a tough game to win. Southampton, they're a good team, but, you know, that's not a bad situation. That feels like a coin flip, doesn't it? And if we don't go up, then playoffs can be fun, in theory.
Yeah, losing to Wembley will be great.
Yeah, well, I've not been to the new Wembley, so, yeah.
Yeah, I went last year and watched Stockport lose in the playoff final, so I may as well go this year and watch Leeds lose in the playoff final as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Leeds lose the playoff final, but it was the Cardiff one, you know, the one against Watford against Cardiff. The one against Watford in Cardiff.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty grim. I hate Kevin Blackwell for that. He played for a draw in the playoff final. So yeah, no, I'm fairly confident. Like Rutter's fit now, isn't he? Grove's back, Ampadu's back in defence, which we want if Pascal's not around. Nonto's coming back to fitness, which is a good thing. Some of us generally playing well at the moment. So there's a lot going for us, isn't there? If we get Nonto back in there and get that triple threat behind whoever plays up front, you know, we'll start beating teams again, I reckon.
Yeah. Other thing to know as well is Ipswich's next three are tough. Like, and so we've got Borough on Saturday, and then they have Coventry away, which we know is tough, and Hull away, which is tough.
Yeah.
And they also have to play Coventry on the Saturday and then Hull on the Tuesday before they play Huddersfield again on the Saturday in the last game of the season. So Ipswich will drop points, which I will probably get quoted on now when they win the remaining games, but I think they will drop points, and I think we will drop less points than Ipswich. Leicester, I would probably say we'll win the league now. Now, that's not a bold claim when they're a game in hand and are leading the league currently.
Their game is Southampton, isn't it? That's the only thing. Their game in hand is Southampton, which is tough. They've got Plymouth away next, which isn't a particularly tough game at the moment. Yeah, that's not a tough game at the moment, is it? Have they got a manager yet? I'm not sure.
No, their director of football is managing them. Right. Or their some not a manager is managing them.
Okay, and then they've got reasonably tough-ish games, Leicester. Like West Brom are always tough for everybody. Southampton's tough. Preston away's tough. Preston on their patch, particularly if they're chasing playoffs. And then they've got Blackburn.
Which they are,
on the last game of the season, which is probably not a bad fixture to have, is it? Blackburn will probably be safe by last game. Are they going down, Blackburn?
I don't know. Blackburn they have got tough fixtures. They've obviously got us, they've got Leicester, they've got Sheffield Wednesday and like a West Brom or something.
Yeah.
So they're hopefully fighting for survival on that last day.
Yeah, but the bad though, the Leicester are too good for Blackburn, aren't they? So that's not going to get too carried away.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We'll maybe say that after we're beating Blackburn on Saturday.
true. But I mean, West Brom, Southampton and Preston feel like three tough games out of Leicester's five. It's not plain sailing for them either. So, there's twists and turns to go here. We've always said that. I think it'll go down to last day. I think it'll be in our hands. Yeah. We have to beat Southampton to get promoted. That's my prediction. I'll take that.
Yeah. I'm feeling full of karma after looking at the fixtures and the fact that I just don't think any of those teams are playing particularly well at the moment. So, I don't think it's a case of we need to go 4 out of 4 to get promoted. I think we could even lose a game and still get promoted, and I'm not.
Yeah, 3 wins. I mean, 3 wins and a draw, and I'm not going to say guarantee, but almost guarantees, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You feel like it.
Yeah. So if we lose to Blackburn on Saturday or don't beat Blackburn on Saturday, then I'll be panicking. And I think that is a completely fair reaction.
I think
because that's the easiest game left.
I agree. Yeah, no, Blackburn's the easiest game. Yeah, totally. So yeah, I'm totally completely fine to say that if we lose to Blackburn, then throw fark in the sea. But as long as we don't lose to Blackburn, we get a good win on Saturday, it'll feel like we're back on track, won't it, very quickly.
Yeah, my only concern is our attacking players since the international break. But overall, calm is still okay. That's the takeaway here. And I think that's a good place to close this podcast. So just a quick reminder, the website for our Patreon is patreon.com/ASAW Patreon. We'll be back very soon. In fact, we're doing back-to-back recordings here, but in pairs. So Adam and Martin, who have done pretty much every pod for the last month, are waiting on hand to preview Blackburn ahead of the half-12 kickoff on Saturday. We will then be back next week with a review of that game, and then thankfully, the schedule slows down, so we might be able to get podcasts out a bit easier than we are at the moment. But until then, I will say thank you to Dan.
Cheers, Tom.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. And enjoy the Blackburn game. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.